Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. It is a great pleasure to introduce you to a new guest. We've never had him on the Salieri Report, and I've been spending decades looking for someone who can do what he can do. So, Charlie Stevens, welcome to the Salieri Report. By way of introduction, our topic today is a 21st century approach to energy, and we're going to talk about energy, but in the context of the entire economy and governance planet. So very integrated with the secret governance system and what is going on in the world. So a much more realistic look at energy, both the physical characteristics and productivity of energy, but the politics of energy and the way energy fits into the control grid. And as I said, I've been waiting many decades to find you. And what happened was you were listening to Financial Rebellion and you sent in a comment to the Financial Rebellion email. And the next thing you know, Carolyn Betts and I started having a dialogue with you. And then we started reading your emails on the Financial Rebellion. And then finally we just said, you know, we got to talk to this guy. And so a conversation is, you know, I'm always saying our best intelligence comes from the subscribers and people who email us. But it was certainly the case. And you've been giving Carolyn and me briefings on what we're going to talk about today. And I have to tell you, it's been just marvelous. I say we're in cahoots, and it's just been marvelous to be in cahoots with you. You're coming in from Oregon, correct?
Yeah.
And so I want to go through your background because you have a very unique experience that has developed in you the knowledge and skills to look at energy within a very integrated context of the whole global geopolitics and economy. And it's quite extraordinary for anybody to have that kind of integration. So walk us a little bit through your resume, and then I want to make a couple of comments about it.
Okay. Well, I won't go back any farther than college because I think that's kind of where things in my life changed rather radically. I was in engineering school. I'm a systems engineer. And I was in school at Dartmouth College at the engineering school back in the day, 1970. I matriculated in 1969, so during the Vietnam War. But I went to systems, and it radically altered the way I understand the world and the way I look at the world. My professors were Dana and Dennis Meadows. They were students of Jay Forrester at MIT, and I learned systems by building pieces of the World 3 model, which ultimately is the model that's behind the book Limits to Growth. And the client in that, starting in 1968, in other words, my professor's client, was the Club of Rome. Mm-hmm. Now, the Club of Rome had this idea that population was a major problem, and so they had us model the interaction between the human economy and the earth, essentially. It was a very complex model, but we simplified it quite a bit. But I my task when I was there was to build the coal module, mm-hmm. which was, you know, what happens when you use and dig up and burn coal and all that sort of stuff. So I got an early introduction to climate change because I was reading Russian papers and some other papers on the impact of, you know, coal burning on the atmosphere and CO2 and SO2 and all the other things that happen, uh-huh. particulate matter and all that. And I was trying to incorporate as much of that as I could in the model. So anyway, we went through all of that stuff, and the model, we tested the model by making a radical assumption, which is what you do with these big scenario models. We assumed that no more humans were born after 1995, mm-hmm. 25 years out. So the base case was, you know, what happens, and it kept crashing in 2045. The population crashed, the economy crashed, everything crashed in 2045.
Right.
And so we said, okay, let's, no more humans are born after 1995. Well, it delayed the crash 12 years. And we said, wait a minute, there's something radically wrong here. This can't be. And well, we looked and looked, and there wasn't anything we could find that was radically wrong. But we did come up with the fact that population turned out to only be the third biggest problem, the third largest single factor. The mm-hmm. second largest was affluence, which, what we called affluence. It was the amount of stuff that each human has. you know, right. the amount of vacations they took and all that.
Right.
But the first and largest single factor in the crash of the system was technology.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we went on and did all that modeling to cut the story short. And the book came out in 1970, late 72, early 73, Limits to Growth. And I found it strange, but very telling that the clients led the charge in trashing the book.
And what?
Yeah, they trashed the book, and they led all of the, you know, the current rackets that we'll talk about all joined in and just trashed the book as though it just, it was obviously preposterous. There were no limits. Well, it turns out the reason they trashed the book was because we came up with the wrong answer.
Right.
We said that population was not the biggest factor. It was, in fact, technology that was the largest single factor. And we had some characteristics of technology that we defined that made it that way. Well, they didn't want to hear that.
Well,
and
technology
they didn't want anybody
is,
else to hear
is
that either.
Technology is very important to achieve central control.
Exactly.
Right.
So they didn't want to hear that noise. And so they trashed the book, and most people paid no attention to that later, even though there's two later editions to the book. The model is still running at MIT. After college, I had to go into the Navy. I had signed up during Vietnam, and so I became a Navy officer and went, you know, because I'd gone through ROTC and went off and did my Navy thing for a while. And then I got out of that and decided I was in the wrong life. I was living the wrong life somehow, and I needed to go somewhere else. I got into the energy area, went back to school, master's program at the University of Colorado, and got some more engineering education. And I came out as an energy policy analyst. And mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time at the Oregon Department of Energy, 17 years there as a policy analyst, helping to regulate utilities, focusing on energy efficiency. In the 1990s, sustainability came onto the scene, and I started looking at that with regard to energy and how that played, participated in creating some of the early green building rating systems, created the first sustainable building tax credits in the country and in Oregon, that sort of thing. It was always public policy focused. In the meantime, I'm reading. I've been reading books for years and years and years. I never stopped uh-huh. reading after I left college. And so I've got about 300 serious books in my library that are on macroeconomics, foreign policy, all that sort of thing. And I had seen the military and what it does and the degree to which it misleads people from inside. I'm a retired uh-huh. Navy commander at this point. I ultimately spent 22 years. But I got into this thing about what is going on. When you're a systems engineer, I've always wanted to know how things work anyway, from the time I was little,
right.
but you start looking at things about outcomes, and one of the rules about systems is that the outcomes of the system betray its design.
Right.
In other words, every system produces exactly the outcomes it's designed to produce. And if you don't like
exactly.
those, you have to redesign the system. So I would be hearing things in the mainstream, especially starting in the 80s when the financial, you know, racketeering really got going about
right.
how things worked. And I knew for a fact that that isn't how things worked. And I could look at the outcomes and say, well, that isn't, not only is that not how I was taught that they work, but that isn't how they're working, because I can see the damage that's
right.
going on.
Right.
And so I started really paying attention in about 1982, after the passage of the Garn-St. Germain Act,
mm-hmm.
when the looting of the savings and loan industry began.
Right.
And so I shifted my reading and started paying attention to those things. And nothing made sense for years and years and years. I can say that it all just baffled me for a while as to how the system could be said to be doing one thing and is actually doing something else. Just
right.
It's not political. I figured out it was not political. It didn't matter what party was in charge of what part of the government. It was all the same. It just kept getting worse and worse for
right.
most people. So I said, something's horribly wrong here.
Did you ever notice how many people who tried to correct it in a sensible way got sidelined or assassinated?
Oh, yeah. I paid attention to careers of people like Dennis Kucinich, you know, who was being given janitor's closets for his hearings and things. I mean, you know, that
right.
anybody who had any integrity and was actually saying things that aligned well with how I had learned made a lot of difference. And I knew my government lied. And I knew that things, especially the dark parts of it, the clandestine parts of it. I learned structural engineering in school. That was the other part of what I learned in college was I learned it from one of the leading consultants on the World Trade Center. And so when that building, when those buildings fell down, I knew that something was up because that's not actually physically possible unless you, you know,
blow them up,
make it happen. Right. So, and then I started paying closer attention to that. And there were lies everywhere. Information was disappearing that I knew would, should be there. Things that should have happened didn't, because I had done some of those things, like launched interceptors on unidentified aircraft or whatever. And so anyway, then the Gulf War, you know, came along and it also, and I had known that they had lied about that. The first Gulf War in 1991, I had friends who were actually in it and part of it. And they, you know, we talked about the fact that nothing we were hearing on the news comported with what was actually happening. So anyway, once you have enough of this, you say, okay, there's something going on. And it wasn't until the late, I'd say, the late first decade of the 21st century, 2008-09, when the financial crash happened. And by that time, I had a helpful tutor in financial matters who used to be the VP for risk at Citibank. And who was the VP for risk at Citibank in 1999 when Glass-Steagall was repealed, and who gave me a lot of inside information. Right. And I said, okay, this is a racket. I said, this is a racket. And I, and then everywhere I looked, then it explained everything. All these, it was the whole economy was a racket.
Right.
And the regulators were part of it. You know, they'd been co-opted or, you know, anyway, that's my background. I just, so I read and read and read. I'm still reading, you know, every day I spend 2 or 3 hours reading stuff to keep up with what's going on.
So there were two things about your background that told me, okay, this is a person who can really help us with this. One is spending this many years as a policy analyst, because when I've worked with government or in government, I will occasionally find a very capable person who's buried themselves in the policy or research department of an agency because they will get relatively good pay and a stable situation to study and figure out what the truth is as long as they're quiet about it. Because for the one thing they need, for the utility regulation they need, you know, this week, you need somebody who really knows the facts and really has mastery of the, you know, both the detail and the facts, who can look at it clearly. And so they will give those people wide latitude to dig in and figure out, you know, and access to information. And they will know tremendous amounts. They're just, you know, in terms of their official position, they only speak when they're asked to speak on something, and it's always very narrow. But otherwise, they're free to roam. And I said,
I experienced that.
Yeah.
When I was at the legislature, you know, I could only answer questions that I was asked, and it, and they were, as you say, very narrow, and the whole story almost never came out.
But you were free to, you know, you were free to look at things clearly and in great detail. And that's, anyway, so that was one thing. But the other thing is that you'd figured out the rackets. And you know, I do think being a systems engineer helps you understand the fact that if a system is not going where it's supposed to go, then it will immediately change, learn, change direction. If it doesn't change that direction, it's because it's going where it wants to, you know.
The people who are designing the system, it's doing fine for the people who designed it, you know, until their plans don't work out. And that's the funny thing. Sometimes when you change a system, you're not all that good at predicting what it's going to do.
And that constantly happened. If you looked at the, you know, when I worked on Wall Street or Washington, they would know where they want to go and they would have a theory on how they were going to get there. But then it would be very organic. They'd make a switch and then, you know, sometimes it didn't work or it would work differently and they'd have to calibrate and adjust.
Well,
so
I knew that.
It was organic.
I had a former Navy commanding officer Vietnam vet, you know, shot down three times, all that stuff. But he ended up running wargaming for the Navy and the military at Newport, Rhode Island, for quite a few years. And he used to tell me, we talked quite a bit, and he would tell me, he said, you know, it never fails. These teams on opposing sides of the war, you know, the conflict or whatever it is they're gaming, they would get about three moves in and all their plans went to hell. And he said the people who always won were the ones who were the most flexible, who could adapt to everything that happened that was not as planned.
Yeah.
And he said the ones that lost were the ones who just stuck to their plans no matter what happened. And, you know.
Right.
So about three moves.
Our motto at Hamilton Securities, in our logo, was Rocco at Rotula, rock and roll. Yeah, you need to be flexible. Okay, so we're going to have our discussion today in two parts. So this is part one. Part one, we're going to go through a lot of the energy information that you have. But before we, and then part two, we're going to go through a lot of material that integrates what's happening with energy with the rest of the model. But I want to start with the end in mind and talk about your conclusions. Essentially, if we were going to go to a true human civilization, what are the top three things that you think need to be addressed based on all of your research for these many decades?
Well, the criminal rackets have designed the economy that we're all embedded in. And most people have no choice but to be embedded in it. They're not wealthy enough to sort of separate themselves from it and just not be a victim of it. And it's literally designed to be a victim. So we have to redesign the economy to have a whole different set of goals. That's a systems thing. Right now, the goal is wealth and power begets more wealth and power.
Right.
And in systems language, that's known as success to the already successful.
Right.
And every system that is in that loop, that's a reinforcing feedback loop with no balancing feedback loops to restrain it, collapses. Every system that is in that dies. It commits suicide. Right. There are no exceptions. So that's
right. Privilege destroys the system.
Right. Now, the second thing is that one of the most important things you can do from a systems perspective is move from industrial agriculture to regenerative agriculture. Now, that when you look at that one thing and you back it out to see all the things that it affects in the larger system, it's overwhelming where you can go. And it's the reason why the rackets absolutely don't want this to happen, because you know, industrial agriculture uses an enormous amount of energy for fertilizer, for chemicals, for diesel fuel, for all of that stuff, for transportation because of the long distance between where food is grown and processed and where it's consumed. It's just incredibly energy intensive. Now, some of the people using that energy, like the chemical industry, are poisoning us all, and they're part of industrial agriculture. If you get rid of all of that poison that's going on, all of a sudden our food supply starts to become healthy and we aren't poisoning people with our food supply. Well, if we did that, what happens to the pharmaceutical racket and the medical racket? I mean, you know, if we get healthy, they're doomed, you know? I mean, so you just start looking at all of the system impacts of this one thing.
But to run a central racket, you've got to control the food system. And if you look at the growth of the Anglo-American Alliance, it has grown on this enormous domination of the global food system.
That's true. It has. And so, you know, make sure I'm there. So we have to fix that. And the third thing is, for the most part, they've weaponized an awful lot of things. These people are inveterate liars. And you have to be able to figure out what it is they're lying about and you know, which things are the lies. And so when I look at all this stuff, it's people are confused. You know, there's people who think that the racketeers are collectivists. They're not collectivists. They're fascists, if they're anything. Mostly, right. They're just criminals. They're just syndicated criminals, you know, preying on everybody else because of the way they've designed their rackets and caused us to all be embedded in it. And, you
but,
know,
but it's
thing,
fair to say,
change.
What we're, because we'll get to climate change, but, you know, I've always said the number one problem is the secret governance system, which is my way. Mr. Global is my way of saying, you call it the rackets, I call it Mr. Global and the secret governance system. But it's the same thing.
Yeah, well, you know, James Corbett has done a great job of, you know, chronicling about the last 100 or 125 years worth of how these rackets have, and the various people involved and the organizations have evolved. Right. The only thing he hasn't done yet, anyway, is he hasn't looked back far enough. He hasn't gone back hundreds of years to see all of the earlier iterations of the rackets that were running the British East India Company to essentially do the same thing.
Right.
And they're bankers, you know, this was all run out of the City of London now for almost 1,000 years.
Right.
So, you know, this is the racket. And if you look back far enough, why things happened the way they did begins to be evident. And we don't know our real history because the racketeers have written history. And I mean, if people knew all these things, they would understand that this is not far-fetched and this is actually what's going on. And we need to treat these people as what they are.
Right, so, especially because now if you look at if you look at their planning for the next round of control,
yes,
they're talking about moving around to a control to a level that has never been experienced in human history. And
you look at where they've gone, especially recently, I've begun to understand why they think they can pull this off. I mean, I don't think they can, but I can see why they believe they can.
Right,
they've amassed an amazing not just amount of power, but types of power to control.
And technology.
Yeah, it's all technology-based.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think so back to the three. So one is the rackets, two is industrial to regenerative. So three is?
Well, you and I have had some conversations about this, about, you know, where we think we want to do this, or what we want to get to. But energy is kind of at the foundation of all of this. And so we're going to have to get our energy act together. Unfortunately, doing that in the way we should do it is also a huge threat to the rackets because the economy is built on throughput. And nobody, the primary thing we need to do is get rid of the waste.
So optimizing energy and being smart about energy, bad for the rackets.
Pretty key. It's bad for the rackets, absolutely.
Right.
Because, you
right.
know, and I figured this out when we were trying to regulate utilities. Somebody said the utility should be doing energy efficiency. And I was like, wait a minute, the utilities have no incentive to do energy efficiency to decrease their revenue. You know, that isn't how the system is designed. It's designed to maximize revenue. Right. And that isn't how you do that. Other people's interests might be that.
So let's dive in. And this is what you did for Carol and me that just blew us away and was unbelievably valuable. Let's talk about energy. It's something called EROI or EROEI. And then let's walk through the amount and sources of energy. Let's look at a non-weaponized presentation overview of energy.
Okay. Do you want to go to the slides and
yeah,
walk
let's go to the slides
really quickly.
Yeah, let's go to the slides.
Okay. Let me pull that up and share my screen. Whoops! I'm gonna have to go up here and share screen, and then. We'll go to the slideshow. Okay, so what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to give people a kind of a primer as for the energy world and how things are and have been for a while. And I'm going to go through this a little bit fuel by fuel, just so people have a little bit of background for each of these fuels and where they are in our economy and how important they are and all that. So what you see here is oil production, and the red countries are greater than a billion barrels of oil of production a year, and the orange ones are half a billion to a billion and on down. So you can sort of see who the big ones are, you know, Russia,
so that's
China,
annual.
The United States.
That's annual. That's annual right. oil production. Okay.
Right, annual. And a lot of the metrics are in barrels, million barrels per day, which is a different metric. And we can talk about that. I know what those are. The world overall is producing about 100 million barrels per day of oil. And the United States is producing about 20 or 21. So about a fifth of that. So you can sort of see the countries there. Saudi Arabia is red. You can see that Iran is red. Norway is red. Russia and China are red. And the United States is red. Okay, so those are the big ones. Iraq, which is there between Saudi Arabia, the red of Saudi Arabia and the red of Iran there in the Middle East, is moving into the red, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to take control of Iraq, is because they have an enormous amount, or did, you know, in 1991 and on, of untapped reserves, very large reserves. And so the idea there was to take control and then put Iraq into the red box,
right?
Which they've been in the process of doing. So that's basically, this is what goes on. And Canada is a contributor. They're doing about 6 to 7, 6.5 million barrels a day. Mexico is about 2. So North America is producing about 30 out of the 100.
Right.
So next we'll go to the next slide.
Oh, come on. Can I make one comment?
Yeah.
Because if you look at what is happening in terms of tension globally between the United States and the BRICS, for a long time now, the G7 has been printing money out of thin air, whether euro or dollar, and swapping it for real commodities, including oil.
Right.
And now we have the commodity producers saying, you know, we don't want to make that trade any longer. It's, you know, we'd rather hold on to our oil than swap it for dollars, which are going down in value. And that's part of the tension. But if you look at a lot of the politics between the United States and Russia, it's very much about, so the rape of Russia in 1991 was, how does the G7 investment interest get control of Russian oil? Or, you know, will Russia continue to take, dollars in exchange for oil? Or we don't want Europe to get dependent on Russian oil. But it's very much, you know, Russian oil is very much part of this.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem is they don't want Europe depending on resources that are not controlled by the rackets.
Right. The racket wants to control that landmass.
Right. And the rackets have a very troubled history with Russia that goes way back, about 1300 years, but we won't go into that today. But anyway, yeah, that's definitely a case. So here's another picture of the oil. The IOCs are the investor-owned companies and how much oil they control. You can see there in the top, they hold about 6% of the world's remaining reserves. Russian companies, that's corporations, if you will, Russian corporations control about 6%. Another 11% there, the gold box, is available for negotiation with the nationally owned companies for production rights. But you can see that 3/4 of it is controlled by national oil companies, which is a problem.
So these are government controlled.
Government controlled. And this is why the rackets feel that they have to control governments. That's one reason.
Well, is it one of the reasons they want to get less dependent on oil?
I don't think that the rackets don't want people to become less dependent on oil until they can control whatever follows that.
Correct. Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
So I think that, you know, for now, no, they want to burn up, they want to liquidate all of that capital that's still in the ground and refine it and use it, and then they'll move on to the next, I think, is what the plan is. It's just that parts of that aren't going all that well. So anyway, that's just another view, and it's important to the rackets that this happened. This is just U.S. oil production, and the purpose of this slide is just to point out that when people report millions of barrels per day, it's not just crude oil. Okay, right. The crude oil part of this in 2022 is about 12 million barrels a day, but as you can see down at the bottom, it's a little over 20. Natural gas plant liquids is the number two thing there, and those are liquids. They're just longer chain molecules than methane, which is CH4. You know, it's ethane, propane, butane, pentane, on up. Those are feedstocks for the plastic industry, the chemical industry, the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. So that's where most of that stuff goes. I'm not sure. I don't remember what all the categories of others are, but you can see biofuels are, a million, not terribly much. Ethanol is just short of a million, mostly out of corn.
Right.
Renewable diesel, you know, the rest of the stuff is pretty small.
Right.
But it's all in there. So when you hear 12 million barrels a day, it's crude oil for the U.S. If it's 20, you hear it's everything else included.
Right.
Okay. Now, let's go. Now, here's some controversial stuff that people don't understand. Conventional oil, which is what we've been tapping for a long time, even including deep water, though that's considered unconventional in some ways because it's much more expensive and harder to get at. But a typical deep water oil well will produce 90,000 barrels of oil a day. A lot of our production has gone to shale oil in the last 15 to 20 years. And you can see one well there produces about 150 barrels per day. It can get up.
Now, is this coming from fracking?
Yes.
Okay.
It's fracked for shale oil. It's fracked for shale gas, both.
Right, right.
So they're fracking and they're getting, they start out with maybe 200 barrels a day, 220, but then it declines rapidly. These wells decline in about 4 years. They're down 85% in 4 years, typically. So you got to drill 600 wells at about back in 2005, you had to drill 600 of these shale oil wells at 7 million each to equal the output of one deep water well. And so the price, you can see there, the break-even cost of oil production back then was $65 a barrel, while the break-even on the deep water was $25. So you can tell that the price of oil has to be really high in order to make any money with shale oil. We'll talk about EROEI shortly on that. But and right now, price of oil right now is right around $80 mm-hmm. a barrel. And there's 42 gallons per barrel. And at $84 a barrel, which is what we're forecast to have by December, that's $2 a gallon. There are 42 gallons in each barrel. And so it's $2 a gallon of gasoline is in the price of the crude oil barrel at $84 a barrel.
And it's so remarkable to watch the manipulation of the oil price. So in the 80s, we drove it right into the ground, which was part of breaking up Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So
And
was very much engineered by the rackets.
Well, traders now, you know, it's the commodity traders that really determine how much oil is going to be on the market at any given time and at what price. And I mean, they can store it.
I got tremendous feedback from our subscribers in the oil patch for a long time that essentially you had central banks printing money and a tremendous amount of money being thrown at fracking and shale oil that made no economic sense. And the question
That's
is,
true.
What in the world is going on?
Well, if you subsidize something heavily enough, I mean, I'll talk about that when we get to EROEI, but anyway, the gas situation is much the same. The break-even cost of gas production, conventional, is about $2 a million BTU, and break-even for the shale gas is somewhere between $4.50 and $8, depending on the play and where you are in it. The current price, by the way, this month is about $2.95. So isn't it a good thing that all of that gas is going as LNG to Europe right now at about $20 a million BTU.
What a coincidence.
What a coincidence. Yeah, the blowing up of the pipeline didn't just deindustrialize large parts of Europe. It also saved a large part of the American natural gas industry, the fracking part.
Right.
So anyway, that's just, you know, some reality here that not all oil is the same. Tar sands is ridiculous.
So let me just ask you, Charlie, if the break-even cost of gas for shale gas is $4.50 to $8, if you convert it for transport as LNG and ship it to Europe, by the time it hits the docks of Rotterdam, what's the cost per million
BTU? It's probably about 12.
Okay. And they're paying about 20.
Yeah.
That's a racket.
It's a racket. Of course
it's
it
a racket.
Is. Yeah, it's market manipulation, among other things. But tar sands is another thing. There's been, as you know, there's been a lot of controversy over the Keystone pipelines.
Right.
And a lot of people, you know, in the more conservative part of the country are all up in arms because they canceled the Keystone pipelines. Well, they didn't cancel them because of environmental concerns. That never happens. They cancel them because they make no economic sense anymore. The tar sands, what's in those pipelines, by the way, is not oil. It's something called diluted bitumen or dilbit. It's part tar and part water. And it's highly corrosive. It grows bacteria that eat iron, in other words, iron pipe.
Wow.
In the pipeline. And when it leaks, it's utterly toxic to life everywhere. And it will, those pipelines typically begin leaking in less than 2 years after they're put in service. The other problem, we'll talk about tar sands when we get down to EROEI because it's ridiculous. But I just wanted to point out that an awful lot of people have to do some study to understand what the issues really are around the Bakken and shale oil and tar sands oil and shale gas and all that stuff. We're sacrificing a lot to use a bunch of stuff we actually don't need, but we'll talk about that later. So where the natural gas goes, you can see here at the bottom is residential, and it's been flat pretty much since 1970. Same with commercial. It's hardly grown at all, partly because efficiency of the buildings and efficiency of the appliances that use it have gotten pretty steadily better, a little at a time over many years. Industrial use, you can see the patterns going up and down during the times when we were deindustrializing, starting at about the mid-1970s and going into about 1988 or so. There was a lot of heavy use being moved offshore. Up until about 1996, it went back up for a while as we reindustrialized somewhat. And then it's been kind of flat ever since. However, electric power, that's the blue. You can see the growth in the use of gas for electric power generation. And that's what's part of that has been used to shape the renewables, but we can talk about that in a bit too. Transportation uses hardly any. Anyway, you can find all this stuff as it shows at the bottom there. You can find all this stuff at the Energy Information Administration. So you can get all this data and information. It's really easy. They got a ton of data. So next, this is the other view. Electric power is now using 38% of the natural gas. Commercial industrial together is about 43%. And the chemical industry uses about a third of that. So when you put a dent in the chemical industry because they're poisoning us all, that's the main reason to do this, is because they're poisoning us all. A lot of natural gas use goes the other way, a third right. of 43%.
Now, understanding, I did a couple of interviews with James Norman, who was a wonderful author and reporter who had covered the energy world for years. He was the energy editor at one point for Business Week and then ended up at Platts Trade Journal when he got in a squabble. He was a senior editor at Forbes and he had the mistake of telling the truth about Promise Software and the Reagan administration.
Oops.
Oops. He got too close to the rackets. But what he said was that the number one cost item for American corporations is energy, not labor. And so, energy is very much part, cost of capital and energy are very much part of making the American multinational, competitive globally.
True. And that's, and they solved a lot of that problem by moving a lot of production that was energy intensive and labor intensive both to China.
Right. And they solved their pollution problem.
Exactly. Yeah, the pollution just got moved to somebody else's country.
Right.
So definition, I'm just going to quickly, this is the United States electric generation profile and the way it's been. You can see down there on the bottom is coal. The next one up is oil, that little blue bar that's disappearing. Gas, again, growing. Green, nuclear, yellow. Hydro is the dark blue up there at the top. And renewable and waste generation is on the top. And that's everything renewable except for geothermal, solar, and wind, which has its own little red bar up there. So you can see just how much in 2007, anyway, was being contributed by what.
Right.
This has changed somewhat since then. I'm not going to go through this, but here's India. So you can see coal, oil is blue again. Gas is green, growing quite a lot in India as well. Nuclear, very small. And hydro.
Right.
Coal, big coal. And then here's China.
Same thing.
Same thing. Now, I want you to look at the slope of that curve on the right-hand side of that graph. Does anyone believe that's sustainable forever? I mean, that's just not going to happen. That at some point, the slope on that curve will reverse. And it may not be quite as steep on the downside, but it's going to reverse at some point.
Right.
It's finite. Electricity generation in the U.S. The interesting part about this one is you can see that at the bottom is coal again, brown. Look what's happened to coal since 2007. It's now generating less than half of what it was in 2007.
Right, and this has been very much a policy. I mean, there's been an enormous intervention to make coal drop.
Right, and with good reason, because it was a huge fraction of our CO2 contribution to the atmosphere. And it's less than half of what it was just 15 years ago.
But here's the thing, Charlie, if we cut ours in half, but China and India just keep growing dramatically, does it make any difference?
I think what's going to happen is that everybody uses what they have and what they can politically and economically acquire at the time. And as they can, they shift away. China is going to shift to gas. All the pipelines now coming from Russia through Kazakhstan, that all that stuff is going to displace, a lot of that's going to displace coal.
So one of my questions always was in the last 2 years, if part of what was going on behind the scenes was the rackets deciding to basically shift a lot of the Russian energy east.
Yeah. So it's a complicated space. And to be honest, none of this is actually necessary, but we'll have to talk about that probably some other time. I just wanted to point out that, electric generation has been pretty flat in this country since 2005. It has not been growing, which is a good thing. And that's partly because we've gotten more efficient and partly because we've shifted some of the least efficient stuff and the big users offshore.
Okay.
And I want to just point out the scale of what we have here and what the scale of the problem we need to solve. This is a coal train. Warren Buffett owns the coal, he owns the railroad, and he owns a lot of the power plants. So he's very familiar with all this. So here we have an 18,000 horsepower train. pulling a 1.25 mile long string of coal, 6,000 tons to be exact, about 1,600 miles to the coal plant in Georgia where it's headed, a typical four unit coal plant. Takes 2 days for that train to get down there. Takes a quarter of a million gallons of diesel fuel to run that train down there and back empty. And the time to burn the load at the power plant's 8 hours. So there's a lot of railroad traffic, just looks exactly like this.
Right. It's remarkable when you drive across the West to see these trains snake along. They're remarkable to watch.
They're huge.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just want to give people the scale of what we're up against here. So here we come to energy returned on energy invested, or EROI is also used sometimes, as you pointed out. So this is something that no one ever thinks about, but it's kind of based on physics. And I'll give you an example of how to think of it. Suppose I give you 1,000 units. I tell you that you can a license can be had for very little money to go develop, produce 1,000 units of energy for you to use or for you to sell. And you can sell it for $100 a unit. Okay. So price of oil is 84 bucks a barrel about now. So anyway, 1,000 units, but there's a catch. You have to actually go acquire and invest 1,000 units of energy to get that 1,000 units of energy. So are you going to do that?
No. I mean, I want to always get more energy than what I want to get a multiplier on my investment. Right. So if I invest one, I want to get 5 or 10 or 20 or 30.
So that little problem has an EROEI of 1:1. Okay.
Right.
You put in one, you get one out. Now, suppose I tell you that I'm going to give you $20 a unit. Are you going to do it?
Yeah, because I can make a profit.
You can make 20 bucks a unit, right?
Right.
Okay, so what I just described is ethanol. So it's about 1:1, and it's subsidized to the tune of 20 or 25 bucks a unit.
Wow.
Which is why there's any ethanol in our fuels. Because it makes no sense to do it from an EROEI perspective.
So I could see why a community would do it so that they could basically grow their own fuel.
Not if you have to put in the same amount of energy you get out. I mean, that's chasing your tail.
Well, but here's the thing. If you don't want to trade for it, I could see reasons you'd want to be more self-sufficient. It wouldn't make financial sense, but it might make sense for resiliency.
It's not financial. This again, there's no dollars involved in EROEI.
I should say economic.
Well, again, if you put in a barrel of oil and you get back a barrel, you haven't actually provided any energy to your community.
Right.
Well, you've spent all of the energy to get the energy at the gas pump and you've spent as much as you get. And so you haven't actually provided any energy to the economy. You're using all of the energy to get the energy.
Right, exactly.
Right. So it wouldn't make sense anywhere at any time because you're not providing any energy to the community.
Right, but not all energy. So I have a whole world of equipment that needs liquid energy. So it needs something, you know, it needs gas to go in a tank. So I may have access to, right. So the question is, do I have access to energy that's non-liquid and ethanol is a way to convert it into something that's liquid?
Well, yes. But again, if I have to spend 100 gallons of liquid to get 100 gallons of liquid,
then that's a complete waste. That makes sense.
I mean, and that's where we are with ethanol. I mean, you literally have to spend as much energy to get it as you get. The only reason it's not is it's subsidized.
I've always been very baffled by why we do so much ethanol.
it because it's subsidized.
But why?
Part about it is subsidized. The corn is subsidized. The chemicals are subsidized. The whole system that produces it is subsidized.
But what's the goal?
To make money.
So it's just another racket.
Well, yeah, our economy, that is the primary goal of our economy. It's the chief problem of the rackets. It's to make money. Everything's to make money.
So I would say everything's to control, and then of course you want to optimize your profitability from your control. But if you it's a political, you can create a political excuse to do ethanol. You can get political support for spending money to do it, and then you've got another racket.
True, but remember, in a system, there's a hierarchy in every system. And the thing at the top of the hierarchy, the thing where you have the most leverage over the system and its design, is the primary goal of the system, the goal that trumps everything else.
Right.
And that's to make money. Who gets the money is a lower level in the leverage in the system. So yes, you can alter that system by changing who gets money, how fast and how much and all that sort of thing. But it's nowhere near the effect you can have by changing what the goal of the actual system is. In other words, if the goal of the system was well-being or thriving or something, then all of these things might be part of that, but you would have a whole different design of the system because you're optimizing something that isn't a pile of money and then designing the system so that the stocks and flows accumulate in the coffers of a few.
Right. But when you say their goal is to make money, because I think their goal is very much strategic control. But then what you want to do, it's like controlling a turf, but then what you want to do is harvest it. Now, they can print money out of thin air, but what they're trying to do is print money out of thin air and trade it for real labor and real resources that generates what you're describing as money.
Yeah, they've been doing that a lot forever for taking control of people, the output of people's labor.
Right, exactly.
That's how they confiscate people's labor.
Yeah, it's a confiscation or a harvesting model. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, so now let's go look at how all the different energy sources rack up. I love this chart.
Okay, so we're going to pay particular attention to the little balloons that are connected by arrows, but you can see this is a chart on the left-hand scale is the EROEI, and you can see up there at the top of the scale, it's 100 to 1. And domestic oil in 1930 was about 100 to 1. You could get about 100 units at the gas pump for every 1 unit of energy you had to put in.
Wow.
And so that had declined to about 30 to 1, 29, 30 to 1 by 1970 for U.S. oil, domestic oil. It's still 30 to 40 to 1 in a lot of places like the Middle East, which is one reason why Middle East oil is so attractive. It still has a notably higher EROEI than domestic oil. And you can see the imported oil, wherever we got it from in 1970, was about the same. It hasn't declined, but domestic oil today, and today being 2005, that red balloon down there is now down to an EROEI of about 12 or 14, up 14. Mm-hmm. So the bottom scale is how much of this in exajoules or quads, energy quads, is coming from these sources. So you can sort of see back in 2005, before the decline in coal use started, what's going to happen to coal is the EROEI of coal won't change much, might decline a little bit. It's still up there around 60, but it's going to move. It has moved to the left over the last 15 years. So it's not providing as much of our energy as it once was. Imported oil today, you can sort of see, has gone down just a little bit, but it's still on average 20 to 1. And you can see, over there, down there at the bottom on the left at about 8 is nuclear. So nuclear does not have a very high EROEI. In fact, it's probably closer to 5 if you count everything, which I don't think they did here. Way over on the left and down in that bottom left-hand corner, down there where it's like 0 to 1 down there.
Right.
You can just barely see there. There's tar sands down there, okay? Tar sands oil is down there. Gasohol is down there. Biodiesel is down there. Those things all return less than 3 to 1, typically.
Right.
Tar sands does that because it takes an immense amount of energy to make serviceable oil out of tar sands, out of the tar and the sand. And the reason why dilbit is in those pipelines and not oil is because the Canadians, who have all that tar and sand, declined to use their natural gas supplies, their energy supplies, to fully refine that stuff. So they ship it as tar and water after they take the sand out down to New Orleans and Texas to refine it. So our energy gets used to finish refining that stuff into something resembling oil. So this is kind of the game, but it has a really rotten, like 3 to 1 or worse, EROEI. Wind is up there somewhere between about maybe 12 and 20 or 21, but it has other issues. Photovoltaic is up there, you know, it's reasonable. It might be up around 6 to 8. We'll go through the whole table here. But the point is, you can sort of see where when you get down below about 10, which is where nuclear sits, that stuff is not necessarily going to play out, because Charlie Hall, who did this work, basically suggested that the United States, because of its incredibly energy intensive and complex infrastructure, needs an EROEI overall of about 5 to 8 to 1 just to maintain what we already have.
Right.
No building of anything new, just to maintain what we already have.
Now, when you look at these numbers, you know, because I have spent a fair amount of time in the last 2 years next to big developments of solar or windmill and listened to a lot of discussion of what the real costs are. And if you look at what the official costs are, they really don't take into account the environmental disaster, which is 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road. And
that's true. That's absolutely true. But that's true of just about every energy source we use.
Okay. Okay.
So they have different, you know, impacts and different things, but we don't take any of that into account in the decision making, because again, the goal of the system it's all embedded in is money, making more money with whatever it is you're doing. And the decision is, can we make money, not can we do this in a sensible way, or will this improve our well-being?
Right.
You know,
and that includes can we develop the political support for subsidy? Because
yes,
many of these different sources have tremendous subsidy thrown at them.
Oh my God. Yeah, we'll go through this. Here's the list. You can see old oil, 100, Middle East, about 30. Conventional U.S. oil back in 2005 was about 18. It's now a little lower. It's down maybe 14. That's because a lot of back-end shale oil is in our production mix. And you can see shale oil down there at the bottom in red. It's 3. So the more shale oil you add to our production, the lower our overall EROEI for domestic oil goes. So shale gas, 8 to 10, not terribly good. Conventional natural gas, about 20. That's not too terrible. But conventional natural gas is in decline.
Now, I thought solar had improved dramatically since 2005 in terms of its EROEI. Is that the case?
It could. It could, but it, for reasons I don't fully understand, the technologies, for instance, Boeing came up with a technology years ago that looked like it had an efficiency between 35 and 40% instead of 18 to 20%. That never came to market. And right. I don't know why it never came to market, but it didn't. And if you doubled the efficiency, plus it didn't use nearly as much material, which meant the input energy was a lot lower. But it never came to market. It was, you know, they developed that based on their space technology. You know, they use photovoltaics right. for satellites and all that sort of thing. So that's the expertise that they brought to the table to do that. But it never came to the market. It has potential to do better. Hydropower has always been pretty good. The high end is like a run of river, small scale stuff. And the bigger the scale, the lower the number. Wind 5 to 10, it's not particularly good. And it's probably worse than that when you get down to it. I don't think they fully accounted for how that was going to evolve. Nuclear, now that they're starting to use a lot of energy just to keep the waste fuel cool, wherever it gets stored, it's the ROEI of nuclear is going down. Nuclear has never made any sense. The nuclear program in this country was about nothing but supporting the nuclear weapons industry. If the nuclear industry had to actually pay its own way with no subsidies, it would die tomorrow.
Why has nuclear been so successful in France?
Subsidies.
Okay.
That's the other thing. It's all subsidized, but and you know, it's supporting their nuclear weapons program too.
Right.
The other thing about nuclear is if nuclear had to insure itself for whatever damage it does to the planet mm-hmm. or populations, nearby communities or whatever, they'd go out of business tomorrow. I mean, think about Fukushima.
Right.
What's happened with nuclear is that the public has totally supported that technology and paid for almost all of it because it can't pay for itself it can't compete. You know, right. We'd be paying 50, 60 cents a kilowatt hour if we did it all with nuclear. The other thing is that the public has taken on all of the risk of any right. kind of mishap that may occur with nuclear.
Right. That's the big one.
Yeah.
Right.
But both of those reasons are reasons to just give up on using nuclear power to generate electricity is like swatting flies with a howitzer. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. It never did, except to support the weapons program. So you can sort of see here, you know, where we are, shale oil, ethanol, oil sands, that none of that stuff makes any sense. It's anything that's less than 5 is going to be a net loss for this country. It's going to force us to spend the energy to go get energy that we could have spent on maintaining this country's societal infrastructure.
Right.
And that's eventually why our infrastructure goes to pot. But so do you have any other things you want to talk about with that?
One thing I do want to point out, which is related when you look at the whole economy. For many decades, we have been printing money and sending it to local communities in the form of federal grants that mm-hmm. have them build infrastructure that they cannot afford to maintain.
Yes.
And that's been going on for decades. And if you look at the accumulated maintenance bill coming due,
yeah,
it's an enormous question mark. And if you look at how this hits and works in communities, it's a reason for, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's one of the reasons that drives productivity down, because in fact, you've got a lot of financial methadone rolling in and getting people to put their time and effort into things which aren't economic. And
yeah, Kurt Vonnegut once said that we Americans have a character flaw. Everybody wants to build something and nobody wants to do maintenance. but you pointed out why that is.
Yeah. And if you look at the fact that this huge maintenance bill is coming due on things that I would argue many of which are not economic, the fact that we're dealing with this sort of energy productivity decline at the same time the two things are going to come together in sort of a lethal economic way. And it's another reason why I think they want total financial transaction control and complete control to sort of deal with the adjustment.
That's true. Let me give you an example, though, of a systems thing that is going to potentially give an example of what's actually going on. There is a racket in the transportation industry, of course, no surprise there, right? Back in 1996, this guy walked into my office at the Oregon Department of Energy and said that he had a pavement technology that had a structural design life of 50 years. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, no maintenance for 50 years. I said, you're kidding. And he said, no. And so I sat down with him and we talked to him for, I talked with him for a while and I looked at it. And as soon as I saw it, I said, oh my God, this guy who he was represented, the engineer who designed this in 1980, when he was working for the US Forest Service, this guy has designed a pavement that is essentially an asphalt I-beam. And I said, wow, this is astounding. And I have a structural engineering education. I looked at this thing and I said, wow, any bridge designer would see it right away. And I said, okay. I said, what's it cost? I said, and he said, well, the experience, that is a problem. It costs about 30 or 40% less than what we're doing now. And I said, that is a problem. So I said it lasts for 50 years. It needs no maintenance every 7 or 8 years like we do now. And it costs less than what we're doing now. I said, it's doomed. And it was. Caltrans, yeah. And I watched the Oregon Department of Transportation kill a project, a demo project. But it turned out to be true. There's some stuff, some of this is in the ground in California, and it hasn't had any maintenance since 1983. And it's still getting 100 out of 100 on its payment rating.
So there are, in my experience, there are millions of these innovations which have been, you know, destroyed, stopped, shuttled, shut down. In other words, the productivity potential, if you were really going to optimize the economy, is pretty astonishing.
Oh, yeah. They're everywhere. The rackets have designed this for throughput and waste. I mean, that the overhead in our economy is enormous. It's probably
40%. And it's a plan. It's a plan.
Yeah.
Well, that's why when they come and say, we have to do this thing because we need efficiency, you know, I'm always looking like, you must be kidding me.
Efficiency of money, maybe. But right. Not of materials or energy or any of that. It's that will be stopped in its tracks in most cases and has been. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Michael Hudson, Dr. Michael Hudson, one of my favorite economists, basically calls the rackets and the racketeers parasites. And they are.
You know, I used to call them the tapeworm.
Yeah. And you know that tapeworms emit a chemical that makes the host want what the tapeworm wants.
Exactly.
Right? Well, Michael Hudson says that junk economics, which is the kind of Chicago school economics, is basically the tapeworm's chemical for these parasites. They've convinced everybody that the macroeconomic theories and all of this stuff are what the world is supposed to be. This is economics. It's like, no, it isn't. They co-opted economics before capitalism even got a start. It was still in the cradle and they co-opted it.
One of the most painful things is to watch a true economist interested in figuring out, you know, how to make the economy go coming to the recognition that their chosen pathway of work has been completely compromised. Anyway, let's turn to the control grid because, I'm reminded of that expression, oh no, wait, it's worse. Because if you look at the giant sucking sound of energy going into building the technology and applying the technology for the control grid. I mean, mm-hmm. I dare to say that Silicon Valley has taken energy waste to a whole new level. Is that, would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they have. I mean, they try to make their own operations more efficient. I would say, you know, server efficiency has gotten, you know, it's probably 10 times as efficient as it was just 5 or 6 years ago. But there's uh-huh. also 30 times more servers. So, right. you know, it's going the wrong way, and it will continue to go the wrong way. And this Internet of Things and I mean, you know, just the Bluffdale, the NSA's Bluffdale, Utah server farm uses enough power to power a whole city of about 500,000 people.
Well, digital technology, but complete surveillance.
Oh, yeah.
And complete central control using digital technology is phenomenally energy expensive.
Not, yeah, the to operate and to create.
Right. So we add, so here's industrial agriculture, which is a huge energy user. And then here's centralized intelligence, surveillance, financial control. You know, crypto is a perfect example that gets used a lot. But what we're talking about is while our energy is dropping like this in efficiency, we're applying technology, which is an agriculture model, which serve control, but they don't make any energy sense whatsoever.
True. And the solutions lie in fixing those parts of the system, I think. And I mean, it's I don't know. Well, there's the violence rackets too, which
right.
is part
so
of
we're
going to
get into that. We're going to get into that in part two. But before we end part one, first, I just have to say, this has been a great, a wonderful experience for me to have access to what you've learned over many, many years. One
My
of the
pleasure.
Big question marks over the energy policy is what is breakthrough energy? Is it available? And are they going to introduce it to essentially keep these different rackets going?
Boy, that's probably a show all by itself. Though I have to say, just
right.
2 days ago, I watched a presentation by three physicists who were in Europe at this point. And they basically proved that what Max Planck called zero point energy exists and it can be tapped. It took a long time for the physics to catch up to what probably most of the rest of the cosmos already knows. But it is possible. I worry a little bit about the kind of plunder that might be required to get the resources to create all the devices that might be able to actually take, you know, benefit of that. But I think there is a transformation that's not too far off, and that there's a good reason to make most of what we do electric if we can.
Really?
So, yeah.
So I thought the goal of making everything electric was so you could have complete control.
No, I mean, I'm doing this to buildings, mm-hmm. commercial buildings right now, existing commercial buildings. I typically will go into a building and change out its systems and electrify everything. And I'll reduce the overall energy consumption for heating and ventilating and air conditioning by about 2/3 or 3/4.
Right.
So it's useful to do those things. So, and it's all electric technologies, but to the extent that these new technologies come along, the energy we will get out will be electric.
Okay, so let's stop the screen share. This is the last slide, or is there another slide?
We don't want to use the last slide right now. We will use that one
okay.
when we talk about climate change.
Okay. Okay, so thus ends part two. I should just mention that two members of our team in the Netherlands put on for many years a series of breakthrough energy conferences, and we'll put links in the bottom of the commentary. So I've spent a surprising amount of time sort of exploring the history of other energy technologies which appear to be available and are quite suppressed by the rackets. And the question is the rackets using them in places like underground bases or in spaceships, or, you know, is the rackets using them themselves in their parallels? Yeah, I'm pretty sure they are too. And when will, if they get to a point of complete transaction control, will they then, you know, start to apply those technologies here? Big question mark. But anyway, so we're going to go on to part two next week. But before we close out this part, Charlie, anything you want to add on our current energy profile?
Well, the biggest, again, I think system redesign, and, you know, I don't say this just because that's what I do, but it is the answer to when people say we need different energy, we need to stop using this energy or that kind of energy or whatever, this fuel or that fuel. It's like, wait a minute. How about we stop and look at the system and figure out how much we actually need?
Right.
Because I would suggest that we already generate far more than we actually need.
Right.
We're squandering enormous amounts of energy. And then you look at the other side of that same question, the other side of that same coin, and you say, wait a minute, look at regenerative agriculture. If you go to just regenerative agriculture and you back out all of the energy that doesn't get used anymore, because in part, whole industries go away pretty much. Some of them just shrink dramatically, like pharmaceutical and medical. And then, okay, now let's relook at how much energy we need. With all of that gone, you know, are we still short of anything? No, we're not. And you get rid of the overhead, you get rid of the rackets and all of the energy and resources that they use. I mean, the energy savings are huge.
Well, but in area after energy, so you're saying in energy the same thing I'm saying when I look at capital, which is, you know, there's tremendous waste and it's because of the rackets.
Yes. It's the whole system is designed for waste because try to reduce waste. I mean, Waste Management is a company. And when I say Waste Management, I'm not necessarily just referring to the company called Waste Management, but, you know, the mob has always controlled, you know, waste and waste management for years. And it's a racket. I mean, the more waste we generate, the more money they make.
I know. I'll never forget. I had a wonderful client who was an engineer, and he went to Europe for a month with his family and rented a Volkswagen, which is the same car he has in the United States. And it got significantly better mileage than the one he had in the United States. And so when he got back, he wanted to figure out how he could import one of the Volkswagens that got much higher mileage, to discover he wasn't allowed to. They wouldn't let Volkswagen produce a Volkswagen that would produce that high mileage. And I think part of the problem was that, you know, government taxes were dependent on, you know, it would lower the tax generation of many governments if they...
Well, that's true. But you know what? If you got the pavement right, we wouldn't need all those taxes either.
I know. There you go. It's a system. It's a system.
It is. It's all overhead and waste. I mean,
I always tell people, listen, if you really want to understand the system, what you need to do is look around you and realize it's perfectly optimized for where the system wants to go. Everything is working perfectly.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's working how the people who designed it meant it to work.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, this has been delightful. We're going to be back next week with part two. We're going to talk about a lot of the political issues and then how we do something about this. So, Charlie, I look forward to our discussion next week.
I do too. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Solera Report. Talk to you next week.